You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In the age of the internet, the newsroom, with reporters wrapped in clouds of smoke all furiously typing away to make deadline, is becoming as outdated as yesterday's newspaper. In his debut novel, The Imperfectionist, Tom Rackman, a former reporter and copy editor for the Associated Press, takes his readers into the newsroom of an international newspaper and inside the lives of the men and women who work on it. It was named one of the New York Times' 100 notable books when it was published in hardcover last year. It's now being issued in paperback by the Dial Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Mr. Rackman to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me on.
Are there newspapers like this anymore? I remember going to Europe in the past, and I remember there was a daily newspaper in Rome that was published in English, and I think there were some in other major cities as well. Are they all gone?
I think that most of them are gone these days, yeah. In fact, that newspaper that used to exist in Rome was long before my time, because I worked as a reporter.
I'm older than you, Tom.
I worked as a reporter in Rome, and by the time I got there, it was a very distant memory. There was a publication called Italy Daily. Mm-hmm. They used to come out, but even when I was there, that fell apart and was eventually closed. So.
Well, you have set your story here of an English language newspaper in Rome. The International Herald Tribune is in Paris, isn't it?
That's right, yeah. I worked at the International Herald Tribune for a couple of years on and off while I was writing the book. But the newspaper that I imagined for this novel is not really based on the Herald Tribune. What I wanted to do was to take some of the experiences that I'd had in the international news media and certainly use those as details to render the story more realistic, but it's not based on a particular place.
But when you were living in Europe and working at the IHT, did it feel like you were working on a sinking ship?
No, it didn't. I mean, I think that particular publication has the strength of the New York Times behind it because that's who owns it. So you didn't feel that it was necessarily sinking, but it was certainly the case that in the media at large, you did have a strong sense, and this was true at the AP as well, that these were tough times. I mean, you could feel it in the sort of monthly new things that were restricted and cuts and so forth.
But not European newspapers, aren't most of them still pretty strong?
Well, I think it really depends country to country because there are those countries where they're funded by business organizations and they're not really run simply as companies trying to make it.
I have to tell you, I've often been disappointed by the trip when I'm in Europe. There are large articles on cricket and only an occasional baseball score, and I wonder, who are they writing for? I thought they were writing for Americans who are in Europe.
Well, I think that's probably part of the complexity of putting out that newspaper is that they want to write for anybody who's abroad, really, who can read English and is interested. And you're right that the primary audience is definitely American and the spelling and style is aimed at that audience. They certainly wouldn't want to turn away those who perhaps have a taste for wickets and things like that. So it's a tough job, though, because you're quite right. Every time they take out the line scores, the baseball line scores, there's kind of a flood of angry letters from the subscribers who really are at the heart of the whole enterprise. And it's a tough balancing act.
You tell your story in 11 short vignettes. Should we really call this a novel, or is it a collection of closely related short stories?
It's certainly a novel because there's a continuous story that weaves through all of them and links them all together.
And were you writing it with that in mind?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. That the characters appear in each other's stories. And additionally, in between each of these separate tales, there's the continuous story history of the newspaper itself from its founding in the 1950s up until the present. So you do have these stories of each character, but progressively in between them, you get that whole history which gradually reaches the present day, and when the two collide, then you get the climax of the book.
Your characters range from the newspaper's chief financial officer to one of its readers. Are the job titles as important to understanding the characters as what they do when they're not at work?
I think it's the latter that's more important, was certainly more important to me. I mean, I wanted to do two things with this book. On the one hand, I like the idea of patching together all of the different parts that make up this enterprise. So you have everything from the corrections editor to the publisher and also those characters that you mentioned. But it's a novel that is really about the story of what happens when you leave the newsroom and these lives afterwards when they go home, when they're thinking about what's for dinner and whether their wife or husband still loves them. That's the heart of it.
But would it be any different if they were American reporters working as foreign correspondents for an American newspaper as opposed to working for a locally based newspaper?
I think that the difference is that you, if you're working for an American newspaper overseas, then you have that home base and that's your orbit. Whereas these people are sort of cut loose, and there's something about the expatriate life that I wanted to represent as well. That people who have, for choice or for their careers, have found themselves in another culture and are making a life there, sort of somewhat isolated within it, but nonetheless involved in that local country.
Well, what about the IHT? I remember somebody who was a rising star here at the New York Times. And he just rubbed so many people the wrong way that he wound up being sent over to the IHT, where I guess he rubs Europeans the wrong way. But it looked more like a demotion than, although living in Paris as a way of supporting yourself and your family is not exactly the worst thing in the world.
I was going to say that to be sent to Paris seems like a pretty nice demotion to me. I think it probably would depend on the cases, and perhaps at a certain period and in certain personnel they might have wanted to do something like that. But I think it's changed because the New York Times now views the International Herald Tribune as their international beacon, as their brand. Global brand. So I think that they're taking it much more seriously and they're sending out some very talented people, that's for sure.
Well, the sign over the elevator in the newsroom in your book is "Outside Lies Italy," which isn't a bad thing either. But is that meant as something slightly scary?
No, Italy's certainly not scary.
Italy's a glorious place. If you can't be in Paris, maybe you want to be in Rome.
Absolutely. No, that's more supposed to communicate this strange cocooned life that people live when they're overseas, the way that expatriates have this, as I was mentioning before, they have this little America within an office and outside is whatever country they're in. And it's particularly true, I found, in news bureaus that I visited or worked in, that you actually are obliged for your work to maintain very connected to the culture that you're writing for.
Among your characters are Rich Snyder, a hard-bitten foreign correspondent, and also an aging reporter named Lloyd Burko, who's desperate for a story. Would we find similar types at any newspaper?
I imagine that not at any newspaper, but certainly at a few, because I've had some interesting responses since writing the book from many reporters all around the world, a lot in America, who I hadn't met, who have told me that I know that character is just like this guy in my newsroom. So I set out just to write characters, but I think somehow they some of them are archetypes as well.
So you don't have to really base them on a specific person, because newspapers tend to attract certain kinds of types.
That seems to be the case. These characters are not based on particular people. They're characters that I invented, but I did place them within the roles that do exist within the newsroom and perhaps attract certain character types.
One of the most striking relationships in the book is between that corrections editor you mentioned earlier, Herman Cohn, and his longtime friend Jimmy.
Yeah, the two of them were friends since childhood, and it always looked to Herman Cohen, who's the corrections editor and the man in charge of making sure that no errors get into this paper, although many do anyway. He always viewed his friend as being the capable one, the real talent, the one who'd go on to do something great. And that's how it's been for decades of his life, and he's progressed with his life, feeling always he was a bit of a second best, not in a depressive way, but with admiration for his friend. At the point at which the story takes place, Herman Cohen is in his 60s, and his friend comes to visit him. And in that encounter, after all those years, he comes to realize that his assessment, both of his best friend and of his own life, have not been quite what they should have been.
My guest is Tom Rackman, who was a foreign correspondent for the Associated Press stationed in Rome and also worked as an editor at the International Herald Tribune in Paris and has written a novel called The Imperfectionists, which became a New York Times bestseller when it was released in hardcover, now available in paperback from the Dial Press. Has the response to the book pushed you into thinking of yourself now as a writer of fiction? Or when you were writing for newspapers, were you always a writer of fiction, as some readers suspect?
No, I certainly made a clear distinction between the two roles. Although it is the case that throughout my career in journalism, I had always aspired to be writing fiction, and I had always hoped that I would have an opportunity. And it was always what I was pursuing in my spare time, as distinct from when I was writing news stories. So I suppose that I hadn't always thought of myself as a writer, but I'd always dreamed that one day I would be able to. And that had been the reason that I really got into journalism, was to see the world and gain experiences for fiction. And so I'm very lucky to be able to pursue that full time now.
Did you realize that you were really writing about all of the changes that are occurring in the newspaper business as part of this? Was that your intention from the start?
Yeah, I wanted to make that.
Because, for example, your editor-in-chief is all about the business. You know, in the old days, we had these crusading editors-in-chief who might say, well, forget about how much it costs. We got to tell this story.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I was very aware of the state of the print media because I'd seen it decline in those years that I'd worked within it. And it seemed to me to be a terrific backdrop for the story because up until now, we've tended to see portrayal of reporters and the news industry either as you said, these sort of crusading noble heroes, or on the other hand, the sleazebag, self-aggrandizing reporters. And my experience was something quite different. And I should say as well,
you had sleazebag managers and crusading reporters.
Well, a bit of both, let's say, a bit on both sides. But I think that the one of the things that I was struck by in the actual practice of news was how many of the great principles and ideals of the news business are an awful lot harder to carry out when you're losing money. And that was the real tragedy of that period and of this current period of journalism too.
Well, didn't you graduate from the journalism school at Columbia just as they were starting to teach the new media?
That's absolutely right. Yeah, it was. I'm not sure if it was the year that I was there that they introduced it, but I think it might have been. And I remember looking at those students who were focusing on that and thinking that you know they were sort of jumping away from the heart of what the business should be about, and I remember as well an awful lot of talk, and this was about 1998, I think, about how just in a few years there'd be tablets and there would be no more newspapers. And at the time it seemed awfully hasty, and perhaps it was a little hasty, but it's amazing that now, these years later, a lot of what they predicted is coming to pass.
Well, we have a different sense of how the news is told. I was just thinking about it in relation to the shootings in Arizona, where in the past I would have gotten the newspaper, the morning newspaper, and gotten the first part of the story and then gotten follow-up in the afternoon. And now I'm hearing pretty much the same thing again and again because there isn't much more that has been learned. But we have to keep on talking about it continually. And the web, to some degree, fosters that along with radio and television.
Absolutely. I mean, when I started at the AP, you know, we talked about these news cycles, about how, you know, what we would call AMs or PMs, which meant morning papers or afternoon or evening papers.
And
really,
People actually would yell, stop the presses in those days.
Well, I wish I had heard it once, but I never did. The truth is that there was an idea that you had really two cycles per day and you were responding to the publication of newspapers. But now there's no such thing as a news cycle as it used to be. It's a absolute constant. And you know that every single website you look at needs to be updating. They'll frequently have the minute at which it was updated. And on the one hand, that's great for breaking news and it's great to satisfy our curiosity. But it's not so great when we find ourselves having to pour out endless stuff just to fill the space. And I think the worst example of that is when you watch some of the blathering that goes on TV news, these 24-hour cable channels, where people have absolutely nothing to say and they say it.
You've said that you believe that online communication has resulted in a polarization in society.
Well, I think it's probably a bit more complex than just that. I do suspect that one of the consequences of the massive availability of online news, which I think on its in the most superficial way looks like a great thing, and in many respects it is terrific. But the downside is that with this multiplicity of choices, then everybody ends up picking their own news and picking in the end the thing that is going to more or less confirm what they already think. And less are we exposed to views that might be contrary to our own. Less and less are we exposed to subjects that we might not have known we were interested in. And instead, we will just be cycling through the same sorts of things. And the way that in this multiplicity of voices, the way that they get our attention is how? Is by screaming. And I think that's probably why you see an increasing acrimony in the rhetoric in a lot of news.
But also the pressures seem to have changed journalism. The public editor, I think, of the New York Times just yesterday wrote about the increase in corrections in the paper, partly because the pressure to publish a story very quickly means a lot more misspellings, a lot of facts gotten slightly wrong.
Hmm.
Less fact-checking.
Yeah, I hadn't seen that. That's really interesting to hear. I suppose that if you do have a constant cycle of news, then you just can't be checking things as much. And I do know that from working at the Herald Tribune that when I spoke to New York Times reporters who we were working with there, they would sometimes lament to me on the phone when I'd call them for some sort of update. They'd say, you know, you're the sixth person who's called today and I've still got to meet the deadline in New York. And I think that the burden on reporters and editors as staff are cut all over the place, it mounts, and that's gonna bring errors. It's inevitable.
A listener comments for me and my fellow Americans toiling away in the third world capital during the 90s with internet and even faxes all but banned, reading three-day-old hits in our version of Casablanca was the only thing that kept us from truly believing we were living on the surface of Pluto. Are you working? Are you still working as a journalist?
I'm not. I'm working on a new novel now, and I do contribute every now and then articles. But for the moment, I'm focused on fiction.
Uh-huh. Well, the response to the first book, The Imperfectionists, has been extraordinary. Called Spectacular by the New York Times. It is published now in a paperback edition by the Dial Press. And my great thanks to Tom Rachman, R-A-C-H-M-A-N, for being our guest on today's show.
Thank you very much for having me on.